Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And here they go. Arguments are supposed to be starting right about now at the U.S. Supreme Court on the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's health reform law. 6 hours of oral arguments spread out over the next 3 days. Linda Greenhouse is here to help kick off our coverage, former New York Times Supreme Court correspondent and author of the new book, The U.S. Supreme Court, A Very Short Introduction. Hi, Linda. Welcome back to WNYC. Thank you for joining us on this historic day.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks very much.
6 hours of hearing spread over 3 days. I don't recall anything like this before. Is it unprecedented?
Well, no, it's not unprecedented. Of course, in the old days, in the beginning days, they would argue for days over one case. And I guess the last time they had 6 hours, I read somewhere it was back about 40 years ago. That's before even my time having covered the court for 30 years.
What are they going to talk about for 6 hours? Isn't the issue extremely narrow, whether Congress's right to regulate interstate commerce includes forcing people to buy a product or not?
Well, that's one way of putting it, and that's one piece of the action. So they're actually not getting to that issue today. What they're arguing today is actually whether the court has jurisdiction to decide the case because of an old law called the Anti-Injunction Act, which basically says that you can't challenge a tax in advance of paying it. You have to pay your taxes and then sue for a refund. The question is whether this lawsuit, the suit by the 26 states and the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is what the court is hearing, whether that suit is premature.
So here is a clip of President Obama on ABC with George Stephanopoulos in 2009 when the bill was being debated. Here Stephanopoulos is pressing the political argument that some people make that it is a tax to fine people who don't buy health insurance.
For us to say that you've got to take a responsibility to get health insurance is absolutely not a tax increase. What it's saying is that we're not going to have other people carrying your burdens for you any more than the fact that right now everybody in America just about has to get auto insurance. Nobody considers that a tax increase. People say to themselves, that is a fair way to make sure that if you hit my car, that I'm not covering all the costs.
But it may be fair. It may be good public policy.
No, but George, you can't just make up that language and decide that that's called a tax increase.
The president on ABC in 2009. So, Linda, are his lawyers today taking the same position that it's not a tax?
Well, that's a piece of the argument, but the Tax Injunction Act is very complicated. So the question is, can you challenge the mandate itself, the penalty, they called it, the law calls it a penalty, itself on its face, or do you challenge the way it actually would go into operation? There's many subparts to this. Whether the president calls it a tax or not, whether lower court judges have called it a tax or not, whether the statute does, is really almost beside the point. The court's going to give a functional look to this question, I think.
But does the president's side have an incentive to argue either that it is a tax or it isn't a tax?
Well, they feel they have an incentive to argue that the tax, the Anti-Injunction Act, should not apply because they want a ruling. I mean, they think they have the upper hand on the constitutional issue, which they do, in my opinion. So they want the statute upheld and all these challenges swept away.
Uh-huh. So if they want a ruling, they have to argue that it's not a tax, even though you have the president on TV there arguing that it is.
Well, I mean, just to repeat it, it's actually not going to turn on the precise language. It's going to turn on how this complicated statute actually works. So if it were just, you know, I say it's not a tax and you say it is a tax, you know, the court wouldn't have set aside 2 hours for argument. It's a complicated thing.
Right.
But the government initially didn't want the cases to be adjudicated back when it was when the lawsuits were first filed in the lower courts, and then I think they realized it's really in everybody's interest just to get this matter decided.
Supreme Court watcher Linda Greenhouse, as they open oral arguments at this hour, 2 hours today, 2 hours tomorrow, 2 hours Wednesday at the Supreme Court on the health care law. We can take phone calls. This is a complicated law. This is a complicated case, and a lot of you may have questions. Linda Greenhouse is in a good position to clarify a lot of this for you, which is what we're here for. So give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Those of you who want to play constitutional lawyer can make your case. Everybody else did on the Sunday talk shows yesterday. Why not you? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. But we're very interested in people with questions as we try to clarify what's actually going on here. So give us a call or post your question or your argument to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So as simply as possible on the central issue, under the Commerce Clause, Congress has the right to regulate interstate commerce. The Constitution is direct about that, and it's simple and it's broad. Nowhere does it say Congress may regulate interstate commerce except when. However, the challengers are arguing that this is not regulation of commerce and healthcare. It is forcing people to engage in commerce, forcing Americans to buy something, which they argue is different from regulating it. Is that basically the whole ballgame? Assuming they get past today and decide they do have jurisdiction, whether the justices decide that a mandate is an act of regulating commerce or something other than regulation of commerce?
I guess that's right. I have trouble articulating their argument because I see so many holes in it, frankly. But the basic argument that the government makes is the healthcare sector counts for more than 17% of the entire national domestic product. It's a huge chunk of the commerce that goes on in the United States. And the government's argument is that people who object to acquiring health insurance, either because they can't afford it or they have some ideological objection to insuring themselves and their families, are nonetheless inevitably in commerce for a couple of reasons. One, inevitably, we all need some kind of health care, even if we wish we didn't. And secondly, the fact that the uninsured cost us all lots of money through cost shifting actually is a form of commerce. It's estimated that the average family that does have health insurance pays $1,000 more a year because of the cost of covering all the uninsured. So the notion that I'm not engaging in commerce, I'm engaged in inaction, and Congress can't reach my inaction through the Commerce Clause, in the government's view, doesn't hold up.
So you've given us your full disclosure. You think the Anti-Affordable Health Care Act side has no case here. That's your opinion.
That's my opinion, and I should tell people, you know, if they say, oh, my God, she's got an opinion, I'm actually an opinion columnist for the New York Times, so I'm paid to have an opinion.
That's right. You're no longer the Supreme Court reporter. You now write a column.
That is correct. So if you put me on the air, you've got to take my opinions as they come. I mean, the notion that this is commerce, I just think, is very hard to sustain.
But wouldn't their argument be that it's a question of what an allowable remedy is, if it is commerce, it's one thing to regulate the companies, it's another thing to tell individuals that they must do something. You've heard the Republican presidential candidates define this as the beginning of the end of freedom, because then the government in Washington could tell us you have to buy this, you have to buy that.
Yeah, well, this is a parade of horrible hypotheticals, but the fact is we live in a political system, and here is a law that was passed by Congress and signed by the president. Would Congress pass a law that would say, for the sake of good health, we have to eat broccoli and we can't eat potato chips? No, of course they wouldn't. So, you can make anything seem absurd, but the fact of the matter is we all are required by the government to do lots of things that we might not choose to do. I mean, I spent the weekend doing my taxes. Do I like every single thing that my taxes go to support? Do I wish my taxes would go to support some things that the government doesn't do? I mean, yes, we all feel that way, but, you know, I signed the form and sent it in. So this is the democratic country that we're living in, and the notion that somehow this one statute is the beginning of the end of freedom. You know, if we all want to go back to a state of nature where we don't have a government and nobody has to do anything, you know, fine. But that's not the country we're living in the 21st century.
June in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Linda Greenhouse, legal affairs columnist for The New York Times. Hello.
Yes. Question for you. If this is shot down and people are not required to buy insurance and are not required to pay if they're not buying insurance, then if someone goes to an emergency room and cannot pay for their care, can they be denied coverage and could they be denied treatment?
No, they can't, because there's a whole separate federal law which by some miracle about 20 years ago Congress passed and the president signed that goes by the initials of EMTALA, Emergency Medical Treatment. I forget exactly what it stands for, but it says that if somebody presents themselves in an emergency room in acute distress, they must be treated there. They have to be stabilized there. They can't be simply, quote, dumped, which was what was happening and what led Congress to intervene by passing the statute. So, of course, there are now 50 million uninsured people in the country, and that's the system that we have for treating them in emergencies.
June, thank you for your call. Now, as I mentioned before, everyone who loves or hates the idea of national health insurance plans either thinks they're constitutional scholars this week or Supreme Court justices, armchair Supreme Court justices. So here's a mashup of voices from yesterday's Sunday morning talk shows.
The smart money is betting that the Supreme Court will uphold this law. Now, a lot of the same smart money bet that the Supreme Court would not declare corporations or people and have First Amendment rights.
Why did they take it? Because the circuits are in conflict, and the circuits, some important circuit judges say, in very persuasive opinions, that portions of the law, at least two portions, are unconstitutional.
An expansive view of the Commerce Clause.
Which, of course, says that the Congress has the right to regulate interstate commerce. And everything now is considered interstate commerce. But
that's the problem.
I believe I'm not a lawyer. I don't even pretend to be one. The law is constitutional.
So you recognize Donna Brazile and Cokie Roberts and George Stephanopoulos and George Will and some other voices in there.
Does
all from yesterday? Does any of this broadcast politicking, Linda, matter to the justices? Do they watch Meet the Press and Fox News Sunday?
They might.
And ABC this week.
You know, I never like to pretend I know something I don't know, so I actually don't know. But you know, they live in the world and they're obviously fully aware of the interest in this. That's why, for instance, they're making the audio available this afternoon and tomorrow and Wednesday. People can go on the court's website or on C-SPAN and listen to the argument. And you can always go on the court's website every day and get the transcript of the arguments. But it's clear the justices know this is a big deal.
That's right. And I should mention that, we're having Brian Lamb, the founder of C-SPAN, on as one of our guests next hour, so we'll touch on this. And also, we're providing some specials on the station today, tomorrow, and Wednesday with the audio that they will be releasing from the Supreme Court proceedings. So mark these down. Tonight, tomorrow night, and Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, there will be 1 hour special reports from NPR that we will air. Also, we will air the uninterrupted Supreme Court audio. You can hear the whole thing tonight at 9 on AM 820, and I presume we'll do that tomorrow night and Wednesday night as well. So we will give you the uninterrupted audio of the entire two-hour proceeding tonight at 9 on AM 820, and also the one-hour specials on what goes on at 8 o'clock on both our stations. And, of course, we'll stream those live as well on our website at WNYC.org. As we continue with Linda Greenhouse, former Supreme Court reporter for The New York Times, lecturer at Yale Law School, by the way, as well as a columnist for The Times on legal affairs and author of the new book, The U.S. Supreme Court, a very short introduction. So who's the real audience for these arguments today? Do we already know it's four against four and it's all about Justice Kennedy as the lone swing voter?
Well, personally, I don't see it that way. I actually think the statute is going to be upheld by a wide margin because the only member of the court who really flatly rejects the modern understanding of the scope of the commerce power is Clarence Thomas. Every other member of the court has acknowledged in one case or another that the commerce power is very broad. And so I think this case fits squarely within those. You know, people like to say, oh, it's 4-4, and the justices are going to just vote their politics, just their political preference. There was a poll last week that indicated that that's what most people think. But maybe I'm just a romantic about the court, but I actually think they're going to vote on the basis of the law.
There are no exact parallels in the Supreme Court's past, apparently. Tell me if you think differently from your knowledge. But the ones that keep being brought up as tangentially related are prohibiting people from growing wheat in their backyards as a ruling from the 1940s because it interfered with interstate commerce in wheat, or even growing medical marijuana for private legal use because somehow it interferes with interstate commerce in an illegal drug. I'm still figuring that one out. Are those the closest cases, in your opinion?
Well, yes. I mean, those are Commerce Clause cases that sort of speak the music of congressional authority. There's also another line of cases that come up under another provision of Article I of the Constitution that gives Congress power, and that's the so-called Necessary and Proper Clause that gives Congress the authority to enact legislation that's necessary and proper to carry out other specifically enumerated powers that the Constitution gives Congress. And there's a long line of authority under the Necessary and Proper Clause that's also relevant here.
And didn't Scalia vote with the majority on the marijuana case, putting him
yes.
in the camp of being pretty expansive on allowing Congress to use the Commerce Clause?
Yes, he did. He voted. He wrote a separate opinion. He voted with the majority in that case. And, you know, some people say, well, he was just voting on behalf of the drug exception to the skepticism about the commerce power. But I'll take him at his word. And he read the commerce power broadly in that recent case.
You know who else takes him at his word? Justice Breyer, who was a guest on our program recently. And I asked him, not about this case, but in general terms, about the widespread public perception that the justices are really voting their politics, not necessarily voting the law. And here's part of his answer.
I think the word political is not the right word to characterize them. I think they come from different views about how law relates to people in this country and how general or how specific or how case specific or how bright line a rule you ought to have, how much you should use history, how much you shouldn't use history, how much you should use consequences, how much you shouldn't, how much you look to purposes, how much you don't. They're pretty legal type things, and people look to the document, the Constitution, but they sometimes find different things in that document.
So are you as confident as Justice Breyer is that this is not justices, that we don't often see justices voting their politics, that is, they like national health insurance or they don't, they like marijuana being easy to grow or obtain or they don't, as opposed to really being constitutional scholars?
I basically agree with that take on it to the extent that to say politics is really not to be very explanatory. I mean, people are just hardwired to see things differently. You and I could look at, I mean, one of my favorite recent examples is the whole debate over voter identification. You know, is it constitutional to require voters to show up at the polls with identification? So some people say, this is using a cannonball to kill a mouse because there's no evidence that there's impersonation type of voter fraud at the polls.
Mm-hmm.
But other people will look at exactly the same data and say, well, of course there's no evidence. There's just lots of fraud. And by definition, fraud is not detected and we have to deter it. So those are two different ways of looking at the same mm-hmm. data points. And, you know, is that informed by politics? I mean, in a very general sense, it's true that liberals tend not to want voter ID and conservatives do. But it's deeper and it's actually more interesting than politics.
Tom and Seabright, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning. This speaker made a comparison between this tax law or this between paying taxes and being required to purchase insurance from a private company, a profit-driven company. They're two completely different things. First of all, I got to say that I think it's immoral that we don't have universal health care in this country, and I'm certainly for that. But I think this was a pathetic neoliberal cop-out to just aggrandize big business by making people pay. Even Obama said in the campaign with Clinton, like, why don't we outlaw homelessness by forcing poor people to buy homes? It's sort of ridiculous, and it's not a tax. And I object to it. And if it was a tax, if the rich had to pay their share and make a universal health care available to everybody at some level, that would be one thing. But this isn't a tax. It's requiring people to further enrich greedy medical industrial complex. And, if you'd like to respond to that.
Thank you. And Linda, we got about a minute left.
As a policy matter, I'm with you. As a constitutional matter, I think the law is constitutional. Would I personally have endorsed this law as opposed to the universal health insurance that the caller talks about? No, I wouldn't have.
All right. Linda Greenhouse, longtime Supreme Court reporter for The New York Times, now a columnist for them on legal affairs. She teaches as a lecturer at the Yale Law School, and her new book is The U.S. Supreme Court, a very short introduction. Thank you very much for a medium-length introduction to the proceedings today.
Thank you, Brian.
And remember, folks, as the Supreme Court hears these arguments about the health reform law, stay informed with WNYC. We'll bring you updates and analysis all day. We'll come back to it here later this morning, of course, elsewhere throughout the day. Then tonight at 8, we'll have NPR special summary coverage. And tonight at 9 on AM 820, you can hear the uninterrupted Supreme Court audio of today's proceedings. Check out all the coverage at WNYC.org. And coming up next, as the man who shot Trayvon Martin gets a second look by the justice system, the police officers who shot Sean Bell get their final punishments. Stay tuned.